Digital Creators Podcast. I'm your host, Harry, and we're live in Wylup Fremantle at FrioCast. And we're here with the man who's making this studio happen, Nick Juniper. Welcome, Nick.
G'day, Harry. Thanks very much for having me.
So design isn't just something that looks good or functions well. Design isn't just subjective. It can be measured objectively. And I'm not just talking about marketing metrics from an ad campaign or view counts from a video or sales from a fashion brand. I'm talking about objectively measuring the social impacts from design and how it can have a positive impact on communities. And in this episode, we're going to be looking at this through the lens of a practicing architect with over 25 years experience, Nick Juniper. Nick is a practicing architect with a passion for urban design that has a positive impact on communities. Nick has over 25 years of architectural experience working in tourism, community facilities, and residential resort projects across Southeast Asia, India, and East Africa. Nick is currently the principal at the Falcrum Agency, which leverages community and social outcomes through evidence-based design thinking. Nick also runs FrioCast, which is where we're doing this interview from. FrioCast is a non-for-profit community radio station which connects community through radio. In this episode, we're going to find out about Nick, his story, discover his unique perspective on urban design thinking and the differences of how this is perceived across cultures, talk about his passion for community-based design, his experience working as an international architect, his connection to the Perth creative industry, the social impacts of design that can have effects on communities and how that might be measured, and his vision for his work in Boorloo, Perth and Wylup Fremantle. So, first of all, can you tell us about your story, how you became an architect?
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks very much for the intro. It sounds like we're going to be covering a lot of ground, Harry, today. Thanks very much for the invitation to come down and have a chat. And thanks for your kind of inputs into FrioCast. I think it's been great having you involved in the station, so I appreciate that. I was born and raised down south in Margaret River and a child of parents who... they were kind of, you know, skirting around the edges of the kind of hippie movement in the 70s in Margaret River and, you know, interested in kind of, you know, sort of different kind of ways of living. And it felt like I kind of came home from school one day and they decided that they would pull down our house and build a new house. And so my dad kind of pretty much built our house out of sticks and stones with his own hands and with some design help from Fremantle architect Bob Gare, who's a friend of the family's from in the 70s. And there was kind of this interest in building and design. And so when it kind of came time to head off to the Big Smoke and go to university, I kind of farted around for a couple of years, but I found my way into architecture, which seemed to kind of bring together, you know, kind of creative industry, artistic kind of expression with sort of science and kind of empirical stuff. And it felt like it was quite a good fit for me. Over 25 years have pretty much lived and worked most of that time in Fremantle with a couple of exceptions. And worked in a variety of settings, as your kind of intro suggested. I kind of have worked on, you know, kind of standard sort of residential type architecture. I had a job with a company in Fremantle called Grounds Kent Architects that specialised in kind of international resort architecture through Southeast Asia and did a lot of work in Southeast Asia and across to India and down into Africa. And then kind of found my way to a practice that was kind of more of a design focused practice, kind of traditional kind of architectural practice, and started working with Emma Williamson and Kieran Wong, who are sort of two well-established sort of Fremantle architects, and have been with them for about 7 or 8 years. And with them have kind of transitioned through a few different kind of modes of architectural practice. At the end of 2018, we kind of, you know, we were kind of working together and Emma and Kieran decided that they were really interested in kind of creating an architectural practice that was kind of a little bit different from sort of standard architectural practices. And so we set up the Falkrum Agency back in 2018. And started kind of working almost exclusively with Indigenous kind of communities and Aboriginal kind of clients and stakeholders and corporations. And so our work became quite narrowly focused on in that sector. And I guess from that kind of work came this interest in ideas around kind of social value and kind of design value and what design can kind of bring to projects in terms of kind of creating lasting kind of impacts on the people that we kind of work for. Yeah, so it's kind of been a bit of an interesting journey, really. And yeah, so the Fulcrum Agency is really kind of, you know, we sort of set up as a social enterprise, which is kind of a different sort of business structure. So we're not a not-for-profit, but we're a kind of, we call the, it's called a kind of profit with purpose kind of model. And so as a social enterprise, we're kind of committed to, you know, ensuring that sort of 50% of the money that we make in terms of profit is kind of directed towards supporting the communities that we are working in. And so it's kind of developed as quite a different type of architectural practice in lots of ways. Yeah.
So your kind of work with how urban design has a social impact on communities, that kind of came later in your career?
Yeah, it did, I would say. I mean, I led a pretty standard kind of architectural practice for a number of years. Do you want to fix that camera?
Yeah, you can keep
it. Yeah, and, you know, kind of commercial work, and certainly the sort of the resort work, you know, it was very kind of glamorous and sort of high-end work. And so, you know, the shift to kind of work for the Fulcrum Agency was really quite a significant sort of shift in focus in terms of the type of work that I wanted to be doing. That we wanted to be doing, really. And yes, sort of through that, things dropping apart in the studio here. Through that work, we became really interested in just thinking about how our work as architects could have a kind of, you know, a maximum sort of impact on the people that we were working for. In 2019, just before COVID, I was doing kind of a lot of reading around these ideas of social value and design value. And there's quite a big kind of movement in the UK. In 2012, the UK government released what's called the Social Value Act, and it basically kind of meant that, you know, all kind of major works of procurement in terms of built environment work needed to be able to demonstrate that they would have kind of social value outcomes as part of the kind of structure of the project. And around that kind of grew a whole industry that was really interested in kind of looking at how those social value kind of outcomes could be captured in terms of, you know, in terms of kind of built environment work. And I felt like it was really a really kind of interesting way to start to think about our work as architects and how that work can be demonstrated and kind of measured, really, in terms of the kind of social value kind of outcomes that it delivers.
So in the UK, were they measuring these outcomes as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of methodology, and it didn't really relate strictly to the built environment or to kind of design work originally. I mean, it's a sort of industry and a methodology that has been applied to the implementation of services and service delivery very commonly. People started to kind of talk about social return on investment as a way of kind of capturing what the social impacts of a program or of a service delivery model might be. And it hadn't been really kind of connected to design and the built environment until a bit later. And certainly that methodology in Australia kind of wasn't really kind of considering how those kind of ideas of social value measurement could relate to, you know, design and the built environment. So that kind of came a little bit later, really. But we thought that it would be really interesting to start to think about how, Yeah, I mean, how a methodology like social return on design investment could be applied to the built environment, and to kind of the ideas around design processes and design outcomes. I mean, it's an interesting, you know, people kind of talk about sustainability, and often when people are talking about sustainability, they're really talking about environmental sustainability and environmental efficiency. But really the idea of sustainability is kind of a triangle or a triad of things, and environmental sustainability and is one of those things. You know, economic sustainability in terms of a project being, you know, feasible from an economic sense is obviously another really important part of that sustainability kind of model. But social sustainability is kind of the third part of that triangle, and often it's something that's often overlooked in terms of how how those kind of metrics of sustainability are measured. And the social return on design on investment sort of model, it really kind of seeks to bring social sustainability to the table, and sort of so it can sit alongside environmental sustainability and financial sustainability. And really there's kind of quite a big movement to basically start to think about ways to measure social sustainability and social value outcomes, so that it can be kind of compared to those other metrics. I mean, environmental sustainability is very easy to measure because it's about energy efficiency, and we all know how much energy kind of costs, and therefore, you know, what is saved in energy can be converted into a, you know, a monetary value. Financial feasibility is obviously about finances, you know, yep. So it's kind of connected to monetary value. But it was kind of a little bit of a leap for them to start to think about how social value outcomes could be monetized in a similar way. And, you know, there was a whole kind of methodology that was explored in the UK, and the social return on design investment methodology is really a methodology that kind of actually starts to capture and measure and value and monetize those kind of social value outcomes, I guess. Okay. And when we're talking about social value, we're really talking about kind of metrics around health and sort of well-being,
yeah,
and kind of community connectedness and, you know, kind of, yeah, things that are traditionally quite difficult to measure. But that methodology kind of has some strategies to actually kind of measure those kind of things. So the work in the UK originally was around kind of programs and service delivery. There was a little bit of work happening around the built environment and kind of buildings. Obviously, kind of investments in buildings are significant. You know, buildings kind of, you know, and kind of urban design and urban planning and out and kind of the built environment spaces are large investments by governments. And so to be able to kind of demonstrate that there's value in those investments is actually becomes really important, I think.
Do you think the social sort of impact of urban design is undervalued?
I do think it is. I think it's kind of not necessarily undervalued, but kind of not really valued No one really kind of thinks about the kind of, or has not really thought about until quite recently, you know, what it means in terms of the value of those kind of metrics. You know, kind of what does it mean to kind of value, you know, the well-being or the happiness that kind of people experience as a result of a well-designed kind of, you know, streetscape or a well-designed, yeah, kind of public space. It's been really interesting kind of work. And I guess the other part to that for us is that, and when I say us, I mean at the Fulcrum Agency, because we work almost exclusively in remote and regional kind of Aboriginal communities, we are really interested in kind of engaging with those people and those communities and actually kind of working with them in a really kind of collaborative and kind of co-design type of way in order to kind of start to ensure that their voices and their opinions and their kind of expectations and requirements are actually really well considered in the buildings and the communities that are built for them. It sounds like it shouldn't be a radical thing to actually kind of sit with people and ask them about the type of houses that they want, but it's actually something that hasn't happened a lot in Australia. You know, the traditional model is that housing is delivered by government and government comes to town and they might have kind of one meeting with community members and the decision's made pretty quickly about the type of housing that they're going to get.
Yeah.
Whereas we're really interested in kind of exploring, you know, exploring kind of culturally, environmentally, kind of socially and kind of community-specific design. And it's led by those people who, you know, are going to be living in those communities and in those houses. And so, yeah, that has been kind of really interesting body of work. And I guess as part of this idea of social value, I was really interested in also thinking about, you know, what does it mean for people to be kind of asked those questions about, you know, the types of houses that they want to live in? And what does it mean for their sense of well-being and their sense of kind of ownership and their sense of happiness about the houses that they live in, given that they are kind of contributing to the design of those spaces? Mm-hmm. And so the social value kind of work extended to not only the kind of delivery of the buildings themselves, but really the kind of process of design.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did some interesting studies and sort of research and collected some interesting data on that in the Northern Territory. And it was really, you know, it kind of validated the importance of that kind of process. You know, actually people feel really differently about their communities when they are involved in the design of those communities, and people feel really differently about their houses when their houses are kind of well considered and that they've kind of contributed to some of the design decisions around their houses. So that's kind of really interesting part of it as well, I think. So yeah, it's been kind of really interesting work. And and I think going back to your original question, I do think that kind of architects have always kind of struggled with talking about the value of kind of design in some ways. You know, as a profession, we kind of are constantly kind of placed in a position of having to justify our skills in lots of ways. And that comes down to, an understanding of what it means to be, to kind of what is the value of a kind of, you know, a well-designed building or a well-designed kind of community space. Okay. Yeah, so it's been really interesting work.
Can you talk about some specific examples of work that you've done, maybe with the Indigenous Communities Projects?
Yeah, I mean,
and
that,
how that has
that work in the Northern Territory. We were engaged by the project has been is up on a place called Groote Eylandt, which is right out in the kind of Gulf of Carpentaria off East Arnhem Land, so extremely kind of remote location. They are a community that's had quite a large kind of mine on their island for a lot of time, and so there is quite a significant sort of stream of royalties that come to the community. So they do have kind of the ability to think about and invest in their, you know, in their communities. And they were, as part of kind of we started working up there in about 2016 or 17, and the Northern Territory government was kind of striking a deal with the people of Groote Eylandt, who are called the Anandiliakwa people. And the Northern Territory government basically, you know, struck an agreement where they would hand back responsibility to the local community for some kind of critical community stuff around infrastructure and around health and around education and around housing. So they were kind of, the Northern Territory government kind of wrote, and they struck this agreement called a local decision-making agreement with the people, the Anandiliakwa people of Groote Eylandt. And as a result of that agreement, the community people became much more responsible for the delivery of housing in their communities. And we worked with them really early on in terms of master planning their communities and thinking about how their communities could be developed and redeveloped and how they could grow in kind of ways that were appropriate to the community from a cultural perspective, but from an environmental perspective as well. And out of that work came this idea that they would think about, you know, the types of housing that they were building on the in the community. And we worked with them really closely over a number of years to think about, you know, housing that kind of responded more directly to their kind of cultural kind of protocols and environmental stuff of there as well. But, you know, really importantly, kind of housing that kind of was designed in ways that actually kind of supported their cultural life. The people of Groot Island have very, very strict kind of rules around family connections and kinship relationships. And, you know, there's often kind of people living in a house that, you know, have to have these avoidance protocols, you know, like, you know, cousins of certain genders can't kind of cross paths or communicate with each other, even though they're kind of sharing, in many cases, sharing a house. And so designing houses that supported those avoidance protocols and the ability for people to live and share spaces in a way that kind of didn't raise cultural kind of tension became really important. And sometimes that was just as simple as kind of having multiple exits on a house. So, if your kind of poison cousin comes in the front door, that you can sort of leave by another door and have kind of avoid having to cross paths with them. I mean, they're sort of subtle kind of cultural obligations, but they are really incredibly important. And in terms of how people are living, you know, the standard kind of government houses that were kind of presented to them didn't address any of those things adequately. And it creates a whole lot of kind of tension and kind of, it's very kind of unsettling to be in a house that doesn't really kind of address those kind of cultural needs. And so we worked with them really closely to think about, you know, how their houses could be designed in ways that supported those cultural obligations, and came up with, you know, a number of designs, and people started to kind of contribute to sort of how their houses were located on their blocks of land, you know, whether they wanted to be their outdoor verandas to be facing the street or whether they wanted their outdoor verandas to be facing their neighbour. Or, you know, maybe their neighbour was kind of a side of the family that they didn't want to have anything to do with, and so they could actually orientate their house away from that neighbour and towards other things. And just kind of those, you know, coming down to kind of site planning of how houses were located in the community. And those houses were built and, you know, people kind of moved into them. And at that point we started to be really interested in collecting data about what it means for people to kind of be part of that process. The outcomes were really interesting. People were kind of reporting, you know, increased levels of feeling safe, increased levels of kind of happiness, you know, spending more time at home, kind of working on their houses and their gardens, and, you know, kind of getting, you know, reduced kind of family conflict, and, you know, kind of a whole lot of kind of outcomes that were reported as a result of those design moves, which was really interesting, I thought.
Yeah, I guess I got to ask how is it actually measured? How are social
values
measured?
Yeah, it's an interesting that. I mean, that's kind of the, you know, that's the trick behind it. I mean, I guess the most important thing is that those methodologies and the social value outcomes that are identified and captured really need to be identified by the stakeholders, you know, by the residents. It's really important. These methodologies have a high level of engagement with kind of the residences and the people who are living and experiencing the houses. So they really need to kind of address that directly. And then it's a matter of kind of capturing kind of qualitative data about, you know, how things might have changed over time, you know, comparative way to the ways that they were experiencing their old houses to ways that they're experiencing their new houses. And then really the kind of monetization of those outcomes can be done in a variety of ways, and really kind of the idea of value is quite a subjective thing, and quite often it is, you know, the value outcomes that are identified can be compared to things that can be valued in a monetary sense. And so people can kind of, you know, scale and relatively rank, you know, their ideas of happiness with other things that they do, that they can kind of place a value on. So there's a, you know, there's kind of things called financial proxies, and which kind of seek to create a financial proxy for, you know, a known value and a social value outcome. There's something called the Australian Social Values Bank, which is basically a database of kind of monetized social value outcomes that you can kind of draw on as a database. You know, as an example, if people kind of experience, you know, if people experience a decrease in family tension and family kind of disharmony, you know, you could start to think about, you know, what is the cost of intervening in a family in terms of providing counselling or providing therapy or kind of providing mediation with a family. Those kind of things have a cost. And so you can start to think about, you know, the fact that those outcomes have improved, that there's a kind of cost saving to those kind of things. So you can kind of use financial proxies and other kind of ways to actually place monetary value on those kind of outcomes. Yeah.
I guess you'd have to have sort of, for example, using the Indigenous communities example, you have to have like a previous relationship, you know, with how that community would operate before you
create
the design
change.
I mean, have something to work on.
I think it's, you know, I think there's a idea of relativity is really important. You know, how things were and how they've changed, I think, is really important. And you know, a big part of kind of capturing the outcomes is this idea of change. You know, what has changed for you as a result of this program or as a result of this house? So there is this. There is a kind of. It is quite important to kind of capture the. The change that people experience really from one time to another. So yeah, that kind of relative idea becomes quite important. So it's really kind of interesting. It's been really interesting work and continues to be really interesting. And I think, you know, the idea that you know, I kind of feel like, you know, with the referendum approaching us on this idea of kind of providing Indigenous people with a voice, you know, in a formal sense, a lot of the work that we are doing is really capturing that idea in a kind of small scale. It's about ensuring that people have a sense of agency and a sense of having a voice in those processes from which they've generally been excluded. I think it's kind of really important. It kind of, you know, it shouldn't be so revolutionary, but it actually kind of is quite a big shift, really, in terms of providing people an opportunity to have an opinion and have some choices. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting parallel between what you do and the voice, because it makes so much sense. Like, I mean, it's kind of obvious, like asking people, like, how would you like to.
Absolutely.
Live in your house.
Absolutely.
Or your community.
I mean, imagine employing an architect and not actually being asked the question about what kind of house you wanted to have, right?
So yeah, that's just...
It's sort of fundamental that we take for granted, but it's not the way that things have been traditionally kind of delivered in Aboriginal communities. And the kind of voice campaign and the idea of kind of embedding that idea in our constitution really is... Yeah, it kind of feels like it's just incredibly, you know, the right thing to do. It just feels kind of really important that that there's a sense that, you know, Aboriginal people need to have an opinion and have a voice in issues that affect them and their communities.
Yeah. Just back on the measuring aspect. So it's mostly measured through, like, is it through like asking them and then you're filling out sort of forms and getting that sort of response?
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple ways. You know, in the example of the kind of work that we did in Groote Eylandt, unfortunately, a lot of that work happened during COVID. And so our ability to kind of travel to community was a little bit compromised. And so we did design a whole lot of kind of community surveys that, you know, that captured thoughts and opinions around the outcomes via a survey that was kind of delivered house to house, not by us, but by kind of the survey was actually delivered by community members. So there was a sense that the kind of community was gathering the data rather than, you know, this kind of white consultant that was flying in. It was kind of a survey situation that we collected that data. But yeah, I think there are kind of multiple strategies, and we are always, you know, in our work, we're always kind of looking for, you know, tools and, you know, different ways of kind of communicating ideas and kind of capturing, you know, thoughts and opinions from communities about the spaces and places that they live in. Yeah. Yeah, so it's been really interesting work and continues to be really interesting, really. This idea of kind of community, I guess, was kind of in my mind as I kind of hatched this plan to kind of build this community radio station in lots of ways. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I guess how I came across Fearocast is I saw on Instagram or something like that. And I was just like, immediately I was like, oh, wow, that's so cool. I've never seen anything like that in Fremantle. And it makes so much sense. I'd love to hear the story.
I kind of hatched this idea. I've kind of, always been, not always, but I've kind of for a number of years been interested and involved in community radio. My son Max, who's now 27, he and I did the training course at RTR kind of back in probably 2017 or something. And I kind of hung out at RTR and did some kind of, 4 a.m. Saturday, 4 a.m. shifts. And then I kind of, got sick of getting up in the middle of the night. And I headed down and I did some work at Radio Fremantle, which is a community radio station that's been operating in Fremantle for 35 years, but in lots of respects, they've been quite invisible in some respects. It's quite, they do an incredible job and they have a huge range of kind of programming and they do a lot of multicultural programming. But I just kind of felt like there was something between those two things. There was something kind of between RTR and Radio Fremantle, and it felt like there was room between those things for something a bit new in community radio. And so I sort of threw this idea out into the world last kind of in July, August in 2022, after doing kind of a bit of research on, what's involved in setting up an internet radio station. And actually it's quite easy to do, really, at a certain level it's quite easy to kind of set up an internet radio station. We threw the idea out into the world and I kind of collected a few people around me that were kind of interested in the idea. And, what came back at us was quite a lot of enthusiasm from the Fremantle community, particularly kind of younger folks like you and your generation kind of really liked the idea, and kind of we got a lot of enthusiastic response, and it sort of propelled me forward, really. And that kind of that response kind of propelled and sort of sustained the idea. And then we held a bit of a fundraiser last summer and raised a bit of money to buy some of the gear, and we still didn't really kind of have a place to be. And then I guess at some point over the summer, I, came across this thing in Brooklyn in New York City called The Lot Radio, which operates on a vacant lot in Brooklyn, and they have a converted sort of shipping container studio. And I just kind of thought, I reckon that would work really well in Fremantle. And so we pursued that idea, and late last summer I contacted the owners of this block of land that we're now situated on, and they extremely generously basically said they have no plans for this land at this stage and why don't you sort of stick the studio there. And it's kind of just an idea that sort of progressed from that point. We bought the container. Through my work as an architect, I kind of hustled for donations of materials, and pretty much every single thing that's gone into the fit out of the container has been donated. Called on family and friends to kind of lend a hand with sort of, manual labor. And yeah, we've kind of created this spot in South Fremantle that's fantastic. Yeah.
And how was like the initial container? Because I feel like that's the biggest cost.
Yeah, so the initial container came, my wife and I loaned some cash to Fremantle Broadcasting, which is the name of the association, to purchase the box, as well as the money that we raised from the fundraiser last year. We threw open a GoFundMe page, which raised, another couple of thousand dollars. We've kind of thrown open the idea of people subscribing to the station and supporting the station. And that's been great. We've kind of got a steady trickle of people who are signing up as friends of Fremantlecast. We're selling t-shirts. We're kind of just looking for every opportunity to raise a bit of money. And then we sort of started targeting Fremantle businesses. And I think that's the point that it really shifted for me, because I suddenly kind of actually there's kind of Fremantle businesses that really love this idea. You know, we had a couple of events in the forecourt here on South Terrace in the early days, and the number of people that would come up to me and say, I love this idea and I've got a business and I do this and how can I help out? And, you know, it kind of just grew from there. So, yeah, we raised enough kind of cash to get us on air really in finish the container, finish the forecourt, and get us on air at the beginning of June, which is kind of awesome. And it's kind of going from strength to strength. And thank you again, Harry, for your interest and your content that you're generating. It's great to have you involved.
No worries. Yeah, it's been amazing using this studio. And also just like growing up in Fremantle, there's been nothing that has really drawn everybody to one sort of thing. And I've never really, I guess when I was like, much younger, I was kind of, there was this like a skateboarding community that I sort of felt somewhat a part of, but other than, and then I was a part of like a soccer club or something like that, but that was kind of separate, but there was nothing that kind of could have everybody involved. Like it doesn't matter. Like
it really seems to have struck a chord with Fremantle and particularly with South Fremantle. We have these kind of monthly gatherings in the forecourt at the end of every month, and we do some live broadcasting and it's kind of BYO, and you've been to a number of them, and you know it's just kind of brings people together. And I think the kind of community spirit is people just are really craving it, and you know people are really loving this idea that we can just kind of come together, listen to some music, share a drink, have a light a fire, have a chat, and kind of connect as a community in a space that's what it's about, right? There's no other agenda other than kind of bringing community together and creating a place for that to happen and a place for people to broadcast their content, their music, their voices, their opinions. And it seems to have been, it just seems to have been really embraced by the community. And we kind of have created this landscaping out the front of the studio. And I arrived one morning and, you know, someone had just kind of brought a whole lot of plants from their garden and planted them in our landscaping, which just kind of like, you know, anywhere else in the world, people rip stuff out. But in Frio, people actually plant stuff for you, which kind of says a lot about the idea and the kind of response that we've had. It's been really lovely.
Especially like having the fire out there and like just like chairs around a fire. Where else can you really have that?
Right. Yeah. It's working really well. And so it's been, you know, I think, you know, in some ways it's just been a kind of side hustle. You know, it's just been a community project that I've done on top of my architectural work. But I think there are connections, you know, there's this kind of idea of the importance of kind of community building, and of those kind of outcomes from a project. It would be really interesting to do the same sort of study on FrioCast and kind of capture some of those, you know, and start to kind of generate some data around what it is that people are loving about this idea and the changes that it's kind of made to the community.
I guess I was going to ask, how does your involvement with FrioCast tie into your passion for community engagement and your work with social impact?
I think there is a connection. I think there really is a connection. I mean, I kind of feel like, you know, a lot of my career was, you know, this kind of resort work that I did is kind of feels like you're building kind of playgrounds for, you know, rich people. And the community work that I'm doing is much more about kind of building kind of resilient communities and well-considered community spaces. I think that the kind of FrioCast idea does kind of connect with that quite nicely, really. And I don't think there's any coincidence, really, that I kind of hatched this plan at a point in my career when I was working on much more community-based projects. I do think there is kind of connection. It's been really nice.
You did mention that we might have to, you know, move to another spot or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, this was always a kind of temporary location. You know, when I got this, when we were suggested this idea to be on this site. I mean, this site has been a vacant block of land for 35 years. Ever since I moved to Fremantle, there's been nothing here. And so I think the people who had bought the land were really keen to kind of activate it. But they've recently decided that they need to sell this land. And so, yeah, there's a for sale sign up. A couple of people have wondered whether FrioCast is for sale. And Freocast is definitely not for sale. It's owned by the community and always will be. So yeah, this land is for sale. So I'm hoping that we kind of get another 12 months out of the deal when that deal is struck. But I think eventually we'll be looking for somewhere else. And I kind of feel really optimistic that, you know, what we've kind of created has, you know, is really valued by the community, and that someone will put their hand up and say, hey, why don't you bring it over here and be part of this space? The investment that we've made inside the container can all be kind of lifted up and put on the back of a truck. So none of that's going to be lost in a new location. And so I feel optimistic that when the time comes, we will find, a new location.
Have you seen, I've seen some stuff popping up at South Beach, some like sauna.
Yeah, there's they're actually a sponsor of Freocast Neighbourhood Sauna. Great business. They've got a sauna down closer on South Terrace towards the city, but they've also got that South Fremantle sauna. And so, yeah, I think, you know, something like that would be another kind of opportunity to be in a public space like
on the beach.
That.
That'd be
yeah,
great,
that would be great as well. We need a power connection and we need an internet connection to do our thing, but I don't think either of those things are impossible. I think there's a lot of opportunities around Fremantle for us to find a new home when the time comes, and I feel really optimistic that that will happen. Yeah.
Does the Freo Council know we're here? And
absolutely, yeah. No, we have. As part of the process of getting us on this site, I went through the full kind of development approval application process, and I've got a DA in place, and I've got a building permit in place, and so we are totally kind of legit in terms of us being here. And we'll need to recreate some of those applications and those kind of certifications in a new location. But yeah, no, the Fremantle Council definitely know we're here. And Hannah Fitzharding, the mayor, has been to a couple of our events in the forecourt. Yeah, so she's a big supporter of the idea, as are the kind of local ward councillors that represent this area. So you know, we're firmly kind of entrenched as part of the community. And I feel like, you know, when the time's right, we'll find another place to be. I'm sure of it. Yeah.
And can anyone be a part of Freocast, and how do you
absolutely do you join? Yeah, I mean, you know, when we created this idea, it was really about creating an opportunity for a huge diversity of voices and opinions and people to pretty much, you know, have an opportunity to broadcast. And we threw the doors wide open in terms of taking on program proposals, and we have about kind of 20 odd programs scheduled in the week, and there's another kind of small handful of programs, kind of new programs in development. And so, yeah, if people have an idea, they can head over to the website. You know, there's kind of links that you can find a program proposal link on the website and head across to a form and fill out a proposal if you have an idea for a show. You know, we're saying yes to almost everything. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of wide open, and there's still lots of space in the program for new stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that, I mean, I love the idea of kind of building the podcast. You know, we've got a couple of your podcasts, there's broadcast, and there's a couple of podcasts that are being created in South Fremantle that are also broadcast on the station. And we've got a new podcast, called On Country, which is kind of an Indigenous land management podcast that's in development, and hopefully the first episode will be landing next week. Using it as an opportunity for podcast creators to get their work out there as well, I think is also great.
Cool. And just speaking about like diversity of voices and that sort of thing, in the landscape of online media, freedom of speech has become like a hot topic. So I'm interested to know your views on like freedom of speech as it relates to Freocast.
Yeah, look, we are not governed as an internet radio station. We are not formally kind of recognised as a broadcast medium, which is really interesting, actually. And I kind of feel like it's only a matter of time before Australia catches up with the rest of the world, because certainly in the States and in Europe, internet radio is huge. But in Australia, the legislated definition of community broadcaster does not include us, which basically excludes us from, you know, the Community Broadcasting Association and the code of conduct that is kind of, you know, that governs generally what can and can't be said on community radio is governed by that code of conduct. Freocast is not a member, and we're not eligible to be a member, and therefore, you know, there's less restriction on what we can and can't do and say. Having said that, we are determined to make sure that FreeoCast is a safe space for people of every gender, of every race, of every kind of sexual orientation or whatever. And so we are determined that, you know, people are free to say and do what they want, but we will not accept any kind of vilification of any minority on the station. You know, that's pretty much the only kind of rule, really.
Yeah. So that's you can say basically no you can hate swear. Speech.
There's no hate speech. Welcome at FreeoCast. Yeah, that's pretty much the bottom line, I guess. Yeah. So, look, freedom of speech in terms of political views, and it is, you know, fine. But the minute that that tips into kind of hate speech or vilification, then, you know, we pull the plug. Yeah.
Cool. I've got a few sort of questions that I've always wondered about sort of architecture.
Sure.
And I want to get your take. So when I visit cities like Japan or France or Italy, it's easy to notice the stunning aesthetics of architecture, deeply ingrained in their urban designs. However, in contrast, in cities like Perth, it does not always exhibit the same level of aesthetic appeal. What, in your opinion, contributes to these aesthetic differences between cities, and how can urban design strategies be employed to enhance visual appeal in aesthetics of cities like Perth?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, Harry. I think what you're responding to when you visit those countries and those cities obviously there's a sort of sense of history in some of those places that we don't necessarily have a lot of, because we're a young country and we're relatively a young city. And I think probably there was decisions made in terms of urban design and planning, which got rid of a lot of our kind of older kind of built forms. Because they were seen as, you know, old fashioned or whatever. And, you know, there was this kind of chasing of kind of a modern aesthetic. And so as a result of that, I think, you know, the character of cities kind of was diminished, really. Excuse me. I think there's also, you know, there's this idea that, Australia has, you know, a lot of space. Right, we have the luxury of a lot of space, and so this kind of sprawl of our cities tends to be, you know, that was kind of the planning mode for a long time. You know, everyone was kind of chasing their own little patch of you know, quarter acre block, which turned into sort of, you know, 500 square meters or less. But everyone wants the house and garden kind of thing, right? And so the sprawl in planning that generated. Is not something that you see, you know, in those cities in Europe. Is not something that you see. There's an idea in those cities of kind of urban density that we've kind of shied away from in Australian cities in a lot of cases. So I think that's part of it as well. There's this kind of idea that we all want our little bit of space and are not willing to kind of live in a more dense environment. And, you know, what comes with that is kind of public transport systems and, you know, ways to kind of get around the city efficiently, you know, which, you know, I think anyone that's kind of experienced those large European or Asian cities can see that an efficient public transport system is really a key to kind of making a city work effectively. And I think there's been a real challenge of that in Perth. I don't know, it's obviously kind of changing and improving, hopefully, with the, you know, with the expansion of the kind of rail lines, but it still has kind of a, you know, there's a lot of kind of disconnection in outer suburbs in Perth. So I think, you know, that idea, I think there's also this, you know, there's kind of high density living, there's apartment living, which I think has kind of increased in the city over the last, number of years, but. And then there's kind of this idea of low density where everyone has their own little block of land and house and garden. But this idea of kind of medium density, you know, in architectural You know, terminology is often called the missing middle. It's this kind of this middle density, this medium density living has been something that's been really challenging in Perth. And I think, you know, frustratingly, you know, in recent months, you know, over the last several years, there's been a lot of work gone into design and working on a medium density housing code, which kind of describes how, you know, what are the guidelines and what are the requirements for well-designed medium density housing. And that resulted in the development of these medium density housing guidelines, which unfortunately the government has just kind of shelved and put on the shelf after a lot of work that's gone into it. And it, to the frustration of a lot of architects and a lot of kind of urban designers, that that document is not going to really see the light of day. And I think it's a real shame, because I think it was a great kind of guiding document on how to kind of do medium density well in terms of design outcomes. So yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of things that have contributed to, you know, what feels different about Perth to those other cities that you mentioned and those other countries that you mentioned. And there's still, you know, there's still obviously issues in terms of sprawl and public transport that are kind of hopefully going to be addressed. Yeah.
So do you think high density living kind of wouldn't work so well in Perth, but medium density is more suitable?
I think there is, there's definitely room, and there's definitely a market for high density living, apartment living. And, you know, you see them springing up all over the city. I drove through Applecross, you know, just the other day, and there's like six cranes in and around Canning Bridge that are building these kind of apartment buildings. And there's definitely a market and a need for that type of density. But I think this kind of idea of infill and kind of medium density is something that is really important. And I think it's actually something that is important, because it will kind of change the nature of our cities and kind of hopefully address some of this kind of idea of sprawl that kind of seems ongoing.
As a young person today, I've noticed that housing costs are higher than ever, and it's becoming increasingly challenging to find affordable options. In the context of Perth, do you think this rising cost of housing is partly attributable to urban sprawl the city's experienced over the years, and how does the history of urban design play in this issue? I think you covered a bit of that.
I think it's worth touching on the idea of housing affordability, because I think it is, I mean, your generation is feeling really stressed by that. I think, you know, the idea that you can't actually afford to buy a property and live in a space that you grew up in, a place that you grew up in, is a real problem. And you know, I think that kind of idea of housing affordability, and I think that also comes back to this idea of medium density housing, right? If we can think about ways of creating medium density living, well-designed spaces, and it happens in Fremantle. I mean, if you look at the Knutsford development over you know, on the way out of Fremo along Leach Highway, High Street, the Knutsford development that's in there.
Is that medium density?
Yeah, that's medium density. And it's you know, it's designed beautifully. I walked past it this morning, the kind of urban interface with the street and the landscaping is beautiful. You know, they're well-considered gardens and, you know, it's actually medium density living that's been done really well. It's not necessarily particularly cheap, but it is certainly cheaper than a house and land kind of package in and around Fremantle. So I think the idea of kind of medium density and well-designed medium density will create a kind of opportunity for, you know, more affordable housing, really.
Do you think it's also to do with cultural values? Because if you go to Japan or South Korea or China, they're kind of like, everyone normally lives in a very small sort of apartment block, and it's not kind of looked down upon if you have like a small space to live.
I think you're right. I think that's certainly part of it. You know, there's certainly cultural differences and cultural difference in terms of expectations around how, you know, in terms of how people live. But I think that's, you know, it's almost like, you know, putting the cart before the horse in lots of respects, because it feels like you know, we have this expectation that we all should have a house and a garden because, you know, there's traditionally the space for that to happen, and that's what kind of contributes to the urban sprawl. And in places where, you know, it's just not possible to kind of build more housing subdivisions in a city like Tokyo or in a city like New York or in a city like Berlin, you know, that people actually have to think about, you know, living in smaller in smaller dwellings, really. And I think probably what comes with that also is this idea that the house that you live in is only part of your environment. You know, a lot of people spend time down on the street. They kind of, you know, the kitchens in those apartments are not, you know, spacious kitchens.
Sometimes they're shared kitchens.
People kind of eat and dine elsewhere, you know, which kind of creates a whole other industry around affordable kind of eating out kind of options. So, yeah, I mean, it's a complicated issue, but I think it does have at its heart some kind of cultural expectations around.
Yeah, speaking about how culture kind of impacts urban planning and design, I also sort of feel here in Australia we're sort of a more individualistic society. Mm. We're not really that community oriented.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's probably part of it as well. There is interesting. I don't know if you know of the Nightingale Housing Project in Fremantle, but Nightingale is really interesting kind of model that came out of an architect's office in Melbourne. And it's basically kind of a different way of how, you know, kind of apartment development whereby they kind of cut out the sort of middle developer person and, you know, and kind of reduce the selling price because, you know, there's kind of margins that are kind of cut out. The Nightingale model has a lot of kind of communal, instead of having your own laundry, there's a communal laundry and there's kind of communal spaces around those buildings. And I think the idea certainly is to kind of create a more, you know, a more cohesive sense of community in an apartment building. So, yeah, I mean, I think that idea of kind of community connection and, you know, of more kind of community living is important. Yeah.
Yeah, as a young person and like a creative artist, I've like creative friends. We've kind of come up with the idea and we sort of love to live in sort of one space as a community, which is similar to the shack building.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we talked about that before we started recording today. And yeah, the shack development over in White Gum Valley. Shack stands for Social Housing Artists Collective, maybe,
yep.
Or Artist Community. Yeah. You know, that was an idea that kind of came out of the early 2000s, I guess. The subdivision at White Gum Valley was a heavily kind of applauded sort of sustainable, you know, environmentally a kind of efficient sort of subdivision and housing development. And the Shack project is located over there and provides, yeah, low cost housing for Fremantle kind of creative people. And I think there was a real acknowledgement that, you know, that the escalation in housing prices in Fremantle was kind of pushing out the kind of creative, population, which was the very thing that people kind of loved about Fremantle, right? So Shack, the housing development in the Shack was a way of kind of addressing that.
Yeah.
And seems to have been really successful. Yeah.
I guess that kind of ties into the sort of stuff you do in a way. Like, if you have that social value of art and the effect kind of art and creativity has on community, and at Shack they have that gallery, so it's like a community gallery space. Yeah. You can have exhibitions, and you have sort of artists living there, so it'll kind of help everybody's well-being living in a place that has like-minded people.
Absolutely. I think all of those things are kind of connected. Yeah, so I think you know, more of that in Fremantle would be great.
And it also might tie into what you're doing. So if you have a, it's more so, I guess you can combine, say, energy efficiency and social impact. If you have like a communal washing machine or kitchen area, it's kind of, you know, saving on water, saving on energy.
That's right. And creating a space for people to kind of connect as a community. Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. Yeah.
So with the work that you do, how does it sort of tie into how would it tie into kind of new development areas? Have you worked on projects like that?
Yeah, we have done. We've worked as kind of consultants on new subdivisions. I think all of those issues that you've talked about in terms of kind of building community and community spaces are kind of reflected in that work that we've done in those kind of ways, and thinking about housing developments and new subdivisions as community spaces, really, as at their heart, is kind of that certainly has been part of those projects. A lot of the work that we're doing currently is, as I mentioned earlier, is kind of in remote kind of communities. But even in those communities, we're talking with those communities about how they want their communities to be kind of, developed, and how they want those communities to grow. And a lot of those conversations are around, not necessarily housing, but all the spaces kind of between the houses and that supporter community, as being more kind of, community-based and community-focused, and looking for opportunities to create spaces where people can come together out of their houses. So it certainly is part of, it's part of the work that we're doing, that idea. Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
I'm unaware, but is, say, the community here in Fremantle, for example, are the residents here kind of asked how their opinion on how they want their community built, or is that something that comes into that?
There's always kind of an there's generally an advertising process that goes on with new housing development. For example, the housing development that I mentioned over in Knutsford Street as a really great example of medium density housing. A little bit further down from that development towards White Gum Valley along Amherst Street, there was a proposal for a new housing subdivision. And the proposal was kind of advertised for public comment, and a lot of people, including the people in my office and a lot of architects around town, objected to this development because it was really badly designed. It was kind of really badly designed. There was no, the outdoor spaces were lacking. The street elevation was all of just about kind of garage doors. The houses were, the amount of houses that they were squeezing onto the land was extraordinarily high. Townhouses were kind of looking directly across roadways into each other's bedroom. I mean, it was just appallingly designed. And there was a kind of a real opportunity for people to have a say about that. Thankfully, the people that had a say about it spoke so well and so loudly that the development was kind of rejected at the, at the highest kind of planning approval stage. So yeah, I think there certainly is an opportunity for the community to have a really important say in, the way that our communities are shaped by those new kinds of developments. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the last thing we need in Perth is more ugly houses.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a real opportunity for people to be involved in those decisions.
I got to ask your opinion on Boxable. Have you heard of these new sort of houses that they kind of they can be shipped and opened up and turn into?
No, I mean, I think the idea of modular, I think what you're getting at is kind of a modular, prefabricated.
It folds out. And
yeah, I think I haven't seen those ones in particular, but there's always kind of work around innovative ways to kind of create and deliver housing. The shipping container that we're sitting in. You only have to kind of Google shipping container homes, and there's an entire industry dedicated to thinking and, designing creatively and creating kind of spaces out of these shipping containers. And I think, yeah.
Can I show you this video? Yeah. Just tap on the one with the grass in the house there and just.
That one?
Yep. So it kind of folds out.
Yeah, right. So it's a kind of modular construction that kind of folds out from flat. It's like a flat packed house, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely kind of a, you know, there's a market for that kind of thing. And thinking about how houses can be built efficiently and effectively. But I think the risk with those kind of, you know, those type of modular houses is that they don't respond particularly well to their specific location, right? And I think, you know, there's a risk that you'll get a kind of, you know, you'll get an off-the-shelf response in an environment that could actually kind of, you know, generate something quite different in terms of the site that it's placed on. So I think, you know, there's certainly kind of risks in that kind of fully prefabricated and modular construction. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot that's appealing about it because, you know, what comes with that is kind of efficiencies, cost reductions. So, you know, often it's attractive. But those type of houses, they're very difficult to adapt as your life changes, you know. They're very difficult to kind of change and add on to or modify. Yeah, so I think there's certainly pros and cons with that type of housing, yeah.
Because I think with the housing, say, here in Perth, there's a lot of diversity in design and that sort of thing. Do you think we have too much freedom here in terms of design? I'm just thinking like in, say, Japan, like walking down the street, it's like beautiful. The houses kind of go together nicely in an aesthetic way.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, there's a consistency, I think, probably is what you're getting at. And I think, I think that that is something that comes from a sense of kind of, you know, tradition and history. But I certainly don't feel like, I mean, I kind of feel like it's important to address every site and every site condition with a, you know, with a different kind of response. And so I think, you know, the idea of kind of creative design expression is important to kind of maintain. There are design guidelines in lots of local government areas that kind of talk about, you know, the kind of things that need to be considered. So, you know, at a high level, there is kind of guiding documents that's kind of, you know, that kind of guide responses. But I think, you know, well designed, I think there's always,
and you're happy with those guides? And
yeah, I think so. Mostly, I mean, I talked a little earlier about the medium density guidelines, and I think it's a real shame that the government hasn't taken the opportunity to kind of ratify the work that's been done over a lot of time and at a lot of cost and with a lot of kind of extremely highly skilled kind of design thinking around those guidelines. It's a shame that the government hasn't taken the opportunity to kind of embed those in legislation, because I think those particular guidelines were really kind of well considered and robust and would have resulted in, you know, a much better design outcomes for that kind of housing, for that medium density kind of housing. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Nick, for coming on.
No problem. We're out of time. We are out of time.
But just quickly, where can people find you if they want to contact you?
So if you're interested in the work that I'm doing as an architect, you can contact me at the Fulcrum Agency. That's the fulcrum.agency is the website. And my email address and phone number are on there. If you're interested in the stuff that we're doing at FreeoCast, head over to freeocast.net. There's a whole different ways that you can kind of support the station or get in touch with the station or submit a kind of program proposal. So the fulcrum.agency or freeocast.net.
I'll leave everything down below. Thanks.